conformal field theories are theories without scales. So they are like a covariant. They transform unitarily under conformal transformations. Then let me first introduce what is a conformal transformation. You have, for example, some space, and then another space, and you have a point. You have a metric there, and then you do a point transformation, and you can obtain a metric at this point coming from the metric here. So let's call it G prime, and this will be a conformal transformation between these two spaces if the metric in this manifold is related to this one by some number. So let's call it. So you can see that another way to say that there is a conformal transformation is to say that this point transformation keeps the angles fixed. If I compute, for example, the scalar product of two vectors here and here, as the metric is just a factor, they will have some factor. But then, if I normalize by the size of the modulus of these vectors, I get the same cosine of the angle. So angles are kept fixed, and in particular, null lines. If I put a vector that is null, I get the modulus of this vector is zero, because it will be zero contracted with G mu nu, and here is the same, just a factor in the mu. So it's, geometrically, there are transformations that keep angles fixed and keep null lines also constant. They map null lines into null lines. So let us think in a theory that has this conformal transformation. It's invariant, the conformal transformations, but transformations that map flat space into flat space, Minkowski space into Minkowski space. So the idea would be if I have the half plane and I make a conformal transformation where I end up, then I could obtain, for example, modular Hamiltonian for this new shape. Then in flat space, the conformal transformations that map flat space into flat space are classified, and you have, of course, you have rotations and translations. These are conformal transformations and Lorentz boosts, but you also have dilatations that you can see trivially that they will keep angles constant, so x prime equal mu. And there is also this other more strange conformal transformations that are called special conformal transformations. XX, C mu. C mu is some vector, arbitrary vector. When I put point, it's a scalar product. So if you do this particular transformation, it will also keep angles fixed. And the question is, what kind of shapes you can obtain from the half plane after doing this type of transformation, Lorentz boosts and rotations? And it's not that difficult to see that the only thing that you can obtain are spheres. Because if you have, for example, now we can think in space-time, so the causal domain of dependence of this half plane is the Rindle wedge. This is time now. Then this will be mapped to something, for example, something like this, with some causal domain of dependence. So the null lines in the boundary will be mapped to the null lines here. But in general, this type of shapes will have some null lines that collide here because of the angles there will collide. And we don't see at the boundary of Rindle space any null lines that collide. So in general, this will not be possible to transform this to this. And the only case is the sphere, where all the null lines will collide only at the final, at the vertex point here of the horizon. So they are parallel. They do not collide until they get here. That, and this point is corresponds to the infinity in Rindle space. So these transformations will map Rindle space into some causal domain of dependence of some sphere. But it's good enough. We understanding this, we can obtain the modular Hamiltonian of a sphere. So how can that be obtained? Well, we have to transform that. But let me do it in a different, more simplified way that is good for for remembering the result. That you see that the modular Hamiltonian here is the generator of boost transformations. So this is a group of conformal transformation. It will be mapped to some generator of conformal transformation that keeps the boundary fix of the sphere, because this boost will are keeping this plane fixed. So we have to look for conformal transformations, generators that keep the boundary, the sphere here fixed. Then you can write down in a conformal theory, you have the property that Tim Yunu has zero trace, and of course is conserved. And with these two properties, you can write down several currents that are conserved. In general, you will have something like this. The most general current that you can write with a stress tensor that is conserved is T mu nu, A nu, plus T mu nu, omega nu alpha, X alpha. So you can easily check using these two properties that this current is conserved. And in fact, the fact that it's conserved, it means that you can build with this current some conserved quantity that is the generator. For example, if you take some surface and you do the integral of over this surface of g mu scalar the vector normal, so you are computing the flux of this current there. So this will be some generator of conformal transformations. And you can see that this one is the generator of translations. A mu is the translation vector. This is generator of Lorentz boost and rotations. This is the generator of dilatations. And this is the generator of special conformal transformations. But of all this, I will only use one fact that is, as you can see from here, is only quadratical in the coordinates. It's T mu nu times something that is at most quadratical in the coordinates. So what is the idea is that now we can think geometrically, and we can think that the modular flow that we have discussed before is given by the boost orbits here in the Rindle space, and this is mapped to something that will be the orbits of these conformal transformations that keep the sphere fixed. So it will be something that will, because of symmetry, it will be something of the sphere. It will be something like this. It goes to infinity here, so you have to go to this point. It comes from past infinity, it has to come from this point. And because of symmetry, it will be something like this. So, and then you can write down the conserved quantity that is a modular Hamiltonian, just doing the flux over any surface. If you take the horizontal surface, it's more symmetrical. And there, you can see that because of symmetry, again, the modular flow is always vertical there. So if you look locally, and it's vertical, it means that it locally is a time translation. So it has to be proportional locally to the energy density, because energy density is the one that integrated give you the time translation. It's the usual Hamiltonian. So you expect that your modular Hamiltonian will be some integral of T00 in this spatial surface. Integrated over the sphere, so r less than r. Time something that you have to find out what it is. But using this fact, you know that it has to be spherically symmetrical, so it can depend on r. Let's say r squared. It cannot be like proportional to r because it's not smooth at the origin. So it's r squared and something that is constant. And why other powers cannot appear? Because this is quadratical in the coordinates. And then you know that it has to vanish at the boundary. So you have to put something like this, where r is the radius of the sphere, something like this. And then you have fixed the form. The only that is missing here is just the constant. But in order to calibrate the constant, you can go to the boundary, here, and near the boundary, you expect to have the same Hamiltonian as in the Rindler space. So you just expand this, and then you get, this is like r minus r times r plus r. So near the boundary, this is 2r. If you divide by this, so near the boundary, this will not be there. And this is just like in the, it's just like this. It's the distance to the boundary. Then you miss the 2 pi. And this is the result, 2 pi. So this has to be the modular Hamiltonian of the sphere. And this has been used recently. And you have seen, perhaps, in other talks that people is using this modular Hamiltonian. Okay, this is, so you can use, for example, this to provide the first law for spheres and to also Bekenstein bound for spheres in conformal field theories. And you can also think now in more general conformal transformations that map flat space to other spaces, for example. Then you are mapping, you can compute, for example, modular Hamiltonian or the entropy in a different way in other spaces. This is what I'm going to do now, to compute the entropy of a sphere in flat space. I will map it. I will map the problem to a problem in the Sitter space, where it has a nicer form, and it can be solved without doing calculations. So the idea is, again, to do a conformal mapping. Then you can think the sphere again. You start by the knowledge of the density matrix, the modular Hamiltonian, the modular flow that we know from flat space in a conformal field theory inside the sphere, and then map the sphere to some region in the Sitter space. This is done, so you write, for example, the metric in Minkowski space in polar coordinates. And then you do this transformation. This transformation comes from people that know this transformation, like Rob, for example. and then when you do that, the metric is transformed you do a coordinate transformation of the metric, and you get that the metric writes as some factor, so you can think in taking it away, and it's a conformal transformation, and it reads like cos theta squared. And this metric is, in fact, the metric of the Sitter space with a curvature radius related to this R here. So it's related to the original size of the sphere. And you can also do another change of coordinates and write it in this way, sine theta. And the metric will get to this form, which is more common to see in the textbooks. There. So then you can recognize, you can compute the curvature of this, and this the curvature is constant, this manifold, and then this and it's positive, then it must be the case that this at this locally is the Sitter space. If you see geometrically what is happening, you have originally Rindler space. This was mapped to the sphere, to the causal diamond corresponding to a sphere, and this is mapped to some place in the Sitter space whose Penrose diagram is written like this. So I'm writing null lines here. So it's mapped to this place, what is called the static patch in the Sitter space. It's the part that is covered by these coordinates here. So it's R less than R, where it comes to a coordinate singularity there. So then, in order to understand what is the density matrix here, you can do the following. You can follow the lines of the modular flow here, and just following the coordinate transformations, you can see how is the modular flow in the Sitter space. And it looks like something like this. Again. But what is more important is that if you follow the coordinate transformations, and suppose that this modular flow is given by this unitary operator, where S is the parameter of the flow, so remember that this was e to the minus I h s. S is the parameter. So it's like, remember that this modular flow is like thinking, what is the time corresponding to which I would assign the modular, the density matrix as a thermal state with temperature 1. Okay, if you follow this flow, what you get here for the Sitter space is that tau is just a translation in the tau variable, in this time of the Sitter. So its tau goes to 2 pi r s. S is the original parameter in Minkowski space. So when you know that, you know that the density matrix has to be thermal with respect to this notion of time translations. So it must be the case that rho in the Sitter is equal to e to the minus 2 pi r h tau, where h tau is just the usual Hamiltonian, because it's just this metric is invariant in the time translation. The coefficients that do not depend on tau. So this time translation is a symmetry of the space. And then the the time translation has a Hamiltonian that is the usual Hamiltonian with respect to this time. It's the usual Hamiltonian of the sitter with respect to this time. And then the density matrix is proportional to the ordinary density, thermal density matrix. This is thermal density matrix in the sitter, where the temperature is just given by the inverse of the coefficient. This is like beta H. So this is 1 over 2 pi R. This is the temperature. OK, and this is why is this useful? Because now you have interpreted the density matrix as a real, like, thermal state, then you can use ordinary thermodynamics to compute the entropy. Yes?
H tau is the Hamiltonian just on the patch of the sitter space? Just on that? Just on part of the?
Yeah, yes. This is a. In static coordinates, yes, this is a. It's a time translation in this coordinates. So it's a. You can also extend it to the other patch, but it goes down there. So the like analytic continuation, if you extend the flow, it will be going down. Good question. In Euclidean time, yes, no, but well, for me, no. For me, it's not simpler, but it can be done. Oh, of course, the symmetry you can follow in also in the Euclidean version, but I'm not sure what you do with the Hamiltonian. But yeah, it should be some symmetry in Euclidean, right? Well, I'm going to go to Euclidean in few minutes. So, so, but the idea is that then the entropy is equal to beta A minus or plus log Z. So this is thermodynamical formula, where Z is the partition function. So Z minus log Z is just the partition function. It's the trace of the exponential of e to the minus 2 pi r h tau. And then you have to, in order to compute the entropy, you have to compute these two terms. One is the energy, and the other is the partition function. So let us compute them separately. And the energy is interesting that I haven't said that the when we do this type of construction, we are implicitly assuming that the state in this new space is some particular state. We started with vacuum, and then we end up with some state here. The state is defined somehow on how we are assuming that the correlation functions transform. And this state is called, because of this construction, the conformal vacuum of the sitter space. And it turns out that this conformal vacuum is the state that is completely invariant under all symmetries of the sitter space. You can see that from correlation functions. This comes from the fact that the usual vacuum here is invariant under usual Lorentz boost and rotations. Then it means that the expectation value of T mu nu in this space should be proportional to G mu nu times some constant, right? And then it means that this constant you can obtain just taking the expectation value of the trace. K, and here is D, the dimension of the spacetime. But we have started with a theory that is conformal, where we said that this operator was zero. But this holds in flat space. I think you have somehow received already the notion of conformal anomalies. I don't know. But I will just state that the thing that once you transform to other space, this will pick up some expectation value that is determined by the curvature of the manifold. In fact, in general, what you have in a curved manifold, so this is zero for the conformal theory in flat space, but in general, this thing is some combination of the local, is local, some combination of the local curvature of the manifold. So in general, it's some combination of constants, call it Bn, some invariants formed by the curvature, this I will call it Weyl tensor, Weyl tensors. Minus one to the d minus two, and this is a coefficient called A. And here there is another combination of tensors, which is called the Euler density. This object here, for example, in two dimensions, in d equal to 2, is just the scalar curvature, divided 4 pi. And in d equal to 4 is some combination. Yes. 2. Sorry? Here, you are talking about this formula. You said that there is a... yes, sure. Right. Okay.
So somehow we're not keeping, I mean, if you define h tau, like I'm telling you, h tau has a constant, or that's not a normalized row, or what do we, what dimension are we following? Because.
What convention for what? For h? Right. Yeah. There is a constant there.
So that's an unnormalized row.
Yeah, there is all these things will end up going to the non universal parts. So these are determinations. Because we are computing some entropy, so it will have some non-universal pieces, but we expect that universal pieces will be preserved. For example, the Loraini term, because it's very hard to deform it. Okay. So. But then you can compute these things in the Zeta space. All these tensors, because of it has a lot of symmetry, they will disappear. And you have some, but anyway, this thing will be finite with some number. Yeah, I'm going to say that. This is just a constant, if you look at locally, this is a number that is not divergent. So it's something constant. So if you integrate in the de Sitter space, it has finite volume, so you get a finite number. So in even dimensions, the energy is some finite number. And we don't care about that because we are computing the entropy in of a sphere in even dimensions, so we only care about the logarithmic term. So it's just a number that will not affect this logarithmic term. And then in D-odd, if you follow this calculation, this is an anomaly, and you see that this tensor has D dimensions. The stress tensor always has D dimensions. So here is a combination of curvatures that always have even number of dimensions. So in all dimensions, there is no trace anomaly. Trace anomaly is zero. So in all dimensions, we have E equal to zero. And then that ends up our calculation of this part. And then we have to compute the partition function there. And then we go to Euclidean and say, well, because the partition function is this trace, so you can think of it as going to imaginary time for the Hamiltonian and do some periodic path integral with this period. And if you do that, you put this coordinate to imaginary time, imaginary, so it's plus here, and then compactify this coordinate in this amount, what you get is the geometry that is a geometry of a sphere. So it turns out that the partition function is the partition function of a d-dimensional sphere. So that tells you immediately that the entropy, indeed, in all dimensions, the entropy will be equal to the logarithm of the partition function of a d-dimensional sphere. So what you get is the log of set t, or sd. So in principle, the constant coefficient of the circle entropy, in, for example, in 2 plus 1 dimensions, will be given by the constant term in the partition function of a sphere of 3-dimensional Euclidean sphere, for example. And this is for all d odd. And for even dimensions, you have to in order to look at the universal part, you have to look at the universal piece, the logarithmic term in the log of the partition function of this sphere, or set. And for doing that, you can also apply conformal transformation. This is very well known result. So this was very well known that this logarithmic coefficient of the partition function in a sphere is just given by the A anomaly. What you do essentially to prove that is to make a transformation of coordinates of the sphere. You dilate the sphere. When you do dilate the sphere from the partition functions, it falls down a stress tensor operator. So you do a transformation of some parameter lambda, where lambda is dilatating. You replace the metric by something like this. So it changes the size of the sphere. And then when you do that, you change the g mu nu, and the variation of the action with respect to g mu nu is the stress tensor. So what you get is that the 2 over square root of g, the variation of log z with respect to lambda, to g mu nu in general, is equal to the expectation value of t mu nu. And then you contract with this variation here, and you obtain that the variation is the integration. So what you get is that the variation of log z with respect to lambda is equal to minus integral over d dimension in the sphere, square root of g, t mu mu, the trace of t mu nu. And then again, you have the trace of t mu nu is given by the anomalies, and the sphere is completely symmetric space, so this cancel, and the only thing that you have is this. But this Euler density is a topological density, so integrated over the manifold, it always gives you some number that in this case is just, for any dimension, is just 2. It's the Euler character of the sphere. So this integral is 2. So when you do the integral, you get something proportional to the A number here. What you get is that the entropy, the universal part, let's say, the logarithmic divergent term will be minus 1 to the d over 2 minus 1 for a log. I have a log epsilon here. That is what I found. But I complete, because in the sphere in conformal field theory, the only other parameter with dimensions is r. So I complete it with r here. This is for d even. So it turns out that the logarithmic term is always proportional to some particular coefficient in the anomaly expansion that is called the A anomaly. In 2 dimensions, this A is what is proportional to this C that maybe you have seen, maybe you not. See, this C is a very important number for 2-dimensional conformal field theories. It's called Virasoro central charge. And it's just another way to write the conformal anomaly, another parametrization, let's say. So with that, you obtain that in 2 dimensions, in d equal to 2, in this case, the sphere is just an interval in conformal field theory in 2 dimensions. Then this is c over 3 log r over epsilon. Of course, there is a constant that you cannot compute because it's non-universal. So this is an old result by Holzen, Larsen, and Wilczek, and was generalized by Cardi and Calabrese, one of the most well-known results in quantum field theory about entanglement entropies. So we have seen that using also conformal transformations, you can compute entanglement entropies. And there are some other, like, techniques. Usually, if you go to the replica trick, it's difficult to compute. But there are people can use their best techniques of quantum field theory to compute some particular cases. But these results are quite completely general and applied to all conformal field theories. Some question up to here? Here, this the formula. This form. No, for the odd, you have only this expression here. I would say that the only universal piece that you can extract from here is the constant term in both sides, right? The constant term of the this is also called F. Is the free energy, the logarithm of a partition function, and of a d-dimensional sphere. While this is like a d minus 2 sphere that is entangling itself in Miss Cauchy space, right? T?
Mm. So, I guess, formally, you could exponentiate a long thing, but if you have to get any shape that you want. But I guess, isn't, in practice, it's just useless to do that. I try to get in mind.
No, I don't think you can get any shape that you want. What I can say is that this can be done for a conformal theory. So, if you want to do it properly, you have to follow these lines and these lines of the modular flow and check that the KMS condition, you have to check what are your correlators, and you have to check that KMS condition for this flow in the Sitter space holds. So it will tell you that the density matrix is precisely the one given by this flow. So this can be done, it's the same story. But maybe what you have in mind is that, because what this is telling you is that the theory that we are putting in the Sitter space for this conformal case, and the state we are putting there is exactly, somehow is exactly the same as in flat space, but written in a different way. But from the point of view of the entropy, all that is exactly the same algebra and the same operators. Of course, we identify some operator with some other operator multiplied by something, or like, but the algebra and the state in this sense is the same. You can say it in this way. Okay. Then I will move to C theorems. How much I have? 45. Okay. Oh, then I will go more quick. Then I will skip this. Let me say that the way with Marina Huerta we arrived to this C theorem in two dimension and three dimension. In two dimensions, especially, was unexpected. So we were not looking at the C theorem. We were trying to understand better some entropy bounds. And then we were playing with strong subadditivity in Cauchy space. And the first thing that you find, the simplest thing that you find is this C theorem in two dimensions. The C theorem was already proved by Samoloshikov, but in terms of something that does not involve, in terms of correlators and positivity of correlators, that does not involve entanglement entropy. So let us see how you can obtain this using entanglement entropy. I later will somehow clarify what does it mean to have a C theorem. So let me just play the game of computing a strong subadditivity for sets in Minkowski space. So I will need three things. The first thing is that I will need this property that I have already talked about, that if you have a set is the same, the entropy is the same as any other Cauchy surface. And in fact, it's a property of the causal diamond. This is because we think there is a causal unitary evolution between these two surfaces, so it does not change really the entropy. So this we can call it causality plus unitarity. The second property that I will use is strong subadditivity, but I will call it Lorentzian strong subadditivity, that is just to take into account that we can apply strong superadditivity always that we have a tensor product structure of the degrees of freedom. So, for example, I am able to apply it if I can write the degrees of freedom on a Cauchy surface, the fields here, I'm calling this, let's say, A, and this B. I can apply it here, and why I can apply it? Because the operators here will commute with the operators here and will commute with the operators here. And the fact that the operators algebras commute can be interpreted as that they are representing the tensor product. So I will have here SA plus SB greater or equal to SA intersection B plus SA union B. And let me say that once you apply it in the Lorentzian context, this strong superadditivity becomes much more powerful than just if you have, for example, only translations in a plane. And the third property is Lorentz invariance of the vacuum. So then let us think in the simplest case of two intervals. But let us draw some diamond here. And I'm thinking now in a Cauchy surface that will be almost null here. So I will take this piece here. There's another one and this. I'm thinking in this Cauchy surface. And I call it this, let's say, x1, x2, and x3. So immediately, this is a Cauchy spatial surface, and I can use this idea. And then I can write SX1, X2. When I put two sets, it's like the union of the two. Then I put X2, X3, greater or equal than X2 plus SX1, X2, X3. Okay, and then the following, we have used a strong superadditivity for a Cauchy surface, and then we can use this other property to relate these entropies, x1, x2, for example. This will be equal to the entropy of this interval, because I can deform this surface spatially to go to this one. They both provide the same diamond here. So I'm writing this A, let's say. So XA plus, and this other surface, X2, 3, I can deform it to this one. So I call it B. So this is SB. And this is greater or equal than this X2 that call it C. So XC. And then this x1, x2, x3 can be deformed to the horizontal line, then we can call D. And the way why we are like deforming it to intervals is because I want to show that this is a relation, a pure relation between entropies of single intervals. So, but as they are entropies of single intervals, I have Lorentz invariant, it should be a function that only depends on the size of the interval. So this, I will replace for any interval the entropy as a function of the size. So I can put here S of, let's say, RA plus S of RB greater or equal that S of RC, where these are numbers, RD. But now I use Minkowski geometry to compute a relation between the size of these intervals between themselves. It's like a parallelogram or something like that, not a parallelogram, something. And you have that the relation that RA times RB is equal to RC RD. This follows just from Minkowski geometry. In particular, we can take these two equal to each other. So you would have something like RA square. Well, let me call it. Let this call, well, it's like a square root of RC RD, the entropy of this, twice, because these are equal to each other. So if these are equal, they are square root of this, and twice the entropy of that, greater or equal than the entropy of RC plus the entropy of RD. And then you can play the game of taking these integrals that are very, very similar to each other. So you squeeze this to very small deviation and Taylor expand this expression, and you get an inequality that is R S second derivative of the size plus S prime R, greater or equal than zero. And from this inequality, you can define some function, C of R, that is equal to R S prime of R. If you see, this function does not depend on the divergent pieces of the entropy, because we have seen that in two dimensions, the divergent pieces are logarithm of epsilon that are additive constants. So when you take the derivative, they go away, and this quantity should be universal, well-defined. And from this inequality, what you get is that C prime of R is negative. So this C is, and S prime is always positive. You can see also from Strong Superadditivity. So this C quantity is something that, if you draw, is something that is going down. Sorry, this one? Yes. No, it's okay, right? Ah, okay, this, yes, this, yes, this one is, sorry. Yeah. So if you go to just ordinary translations and do a strong superadditivity with translation, what you get is just this. A second derivative is positive, is negative. But this tells you that you have to add something positive, and it's negative still. So it's stronger than the one that you get for just ordinary translations. And that's important in order to get this quantity is going to go down. But this quantity, on one side, is as I have already mentioned, is universal. It does not depend on cutoff. On the other, is positive, and on the other is is dimensionless. So this is entropy that has dimension. This is dimensionless. So this is a dimensionless quantity that goes down with the size. And in fact, if you have a conformal fixed point, you can use this relation that we have seen recently, log R over epsilon, then C. It's just a constant, it doesn't move with the size, and it's C over 3. So it's a Virasoro central charge divided by 3. So this tells that if you have, for example, a theory that has some masses or some scales, if you look at very small size, you can think that if you look at very small size, you would see a theory that doesn't have scales, because you already go down below any scale. So every particle is like massless because it's high energy. Very high energy masses can be neglected. And if you look at very large size, you can say, well, all massive particles have already gone, and then I only have massless particles. So this gives you an idea that somehow counting the number of massless particles that you have at to each scale. It's not just massless particles, it's just a more precise definition of a number of degrees of freedom. And you can see that it's always going down relativistic quantum field theory, is always going down between a small size and large size. So this is called a C theorem, something that relates the what we call the fixed points. So the theory that looks like conformal in the sense of doesn't have scales at high energy, and the one that looks like conformal at very low energies, large sizes. So it relates directly some properties of these two endpoints. And the way it does is because you know that there is a theory that interpolates between these two endpoints, and this encodes somehow that you cannot take two conformal theories, arbitrary two conformal theories, and put it at the ultraviolet and the infrared of a well-defined quantum field theory. They have to satisfy this relation that the C of the ultraviolet, in this case, the Virasoro central charge of the ultraviolet, has to be greater than the C of the infrared. As I mentioned, this was already shown by Samoloshiko using other methods, but this comes from entanglement entropy in a rather simple way also. Okay, some question on this? Well, let me, how much do I have? Do I have something? Sorry? Half an hour. Oh, I have a lot. I did it in 15 minutes then. Okay. Some question? Yeah.
Does this C function, the entire C function obtained this way, does it agree with the C function of Samoloshiko?
No, the C function of Samoloshiko is something defined by the correlators of stress tensor traces. And in fact, it's interesting. I will show a picture and then. And then I will come back to your question. So the other question?
So one question, I don't, there's a step which I don't understand, which is the step. So you have R, S double prime of R, you have that equation. How did you go from the equation above to that one? I don't understand the equation.
So say it again, where?
The very bottom equation. How do you go from the one before that to that one?
Ah, from here to here. I just, it's simply that you can put RD is greater than RC, so I'm putting RD, because these are arbitrary numbers, these are arbitrary. The size of this one and the size of this can be anything. The only relation is that this is greater than this. So I'm squeezing this picture such a way that RC and RD are very similar to each other. So I'm putting RD is equal to RC plus some delta with delta very small. I write it again, this in terms of R, let's say I'm calling this R plus some small deviation, and RC is R. So I put it here, and then I Taylor expand this inequality in terms of delta, and the first non-zero term that you get is this one. So this one has to be this one times delta squared. Times delta square, so this thing has to be negative. And you can also go back, and starting from this, you can show that this holds. So this does not have less information than this one. It has the same. Yeah, you have to assume that the strong solidity holds. Yeah, that's what you have to assume. It's not necessarily the case that it's completely factorizable because it's a continuum limit. But if you have some model that is described somehow factorizable with a cutoff, then you have that in the continuum limit. But this is assumed. Yeah, this is important. Well, yeah, you can say that, but nobody has really say, for example, you can say, well, what is really the continuous limit of these things are Bonhoeffer algebras, so you would expect that somebody can prove this Bonhoeffer algebra satisfy a strong superadditivity, for example, there, right? So and the entropies are not well defined, so there is another problem. So you would have to define this particular combination of entropies that is a strong superadditivity and say that this is well defined and finite and positive for this Bonhoeffer algebra. We can think this is correct in our heuristic thinking of quantum field theory in terms of, let's say, local degrees of freedom, but it's interesting that some people could attack this mathematical problem more detail. Okay, let me then mention that these C theorems in higher dimensions, what we can do in higher dimensions. So let me just, can you turn on? Yes. So this is just to, because I introduced this C theorem. Okay. This C theorem in a somehow non-standard way, in a way that people do not discuss this in the literature of quantum field theory. In the literature of quantum field theory, what you have is this idea that you can think the theory, quantum field theory at different scales as a theory where the coupling constants on the Lagrangian will change with the scale. So you go from some, let's say, ultraviolet fixed point where you have some conformal field theory with all the scales, and as you increase the size of the, for example, the correlation that you are looking at, it looks like the correlator of another theory with a different coupling constant. So this is like a flow in the space of coupling constants of all quantum field theories that go from one fixed point to another fixed point. So this is called the Romanization group flow. And the idea is that you can see here something similar, but thinking in some property, in this case, some property of the entanglement for small sizes, high energy, to large sizes, low energy. And at the end, you can trade off between these two languages and show that they are equivalent if your quantity that you're looking at is really a property of the continuum theory that you are looking at. So this is just a plot of this function for fermion field, massive fermion field in two dimensions, free field. And this is a scalar field. And this is just, this one is just half of the fermion. And you can see that the fermion wants to have the same number of degrees of freedom, let's say that the scalar, almost everywhere, but here the scalar goes up to, because the central charges of these two theories in the ultraviolet, when they are massless, are equal, so they have to go up there, and they meet at 1/3 because the central charge is 1. And a commentary to what you were saying is that the Virasoro, the Samolosico C functions that are computed correlation functions of the stress tensor will look like something different here. For example, this is a scalar one, this is a fermion one, and then you have the fermion of one of the Samolosikov, and then up you have the scalar. So the order is inverted. This is not that is very important for the C theorem, but it has some meaning in the sense that you can play the game of producing many C functions with a stress tensor correlators, and they are like changing from the usual Samolosikov ones. But in all of them, the scalar will be up to will be bigger than the fermion. So you will never be able to doing combination of DC functions, obtaining the entropic one where the order is inverted. We don't know what it means is that these C functions, entropic C functions, have information that is different from the Samborowski-Wall, and it has information other than correlators, two-point correlators of the stress tensor. So let me then come to the case of higher dimensions. What you can say in higher dimensions? Well, there is a old proposal by Cardi that is a generalization. What is the natural generalization of the case of two dimensions? That the in two dimensions, the expectation value, the anomaly of a conformal field theory is proportional to this C charge. So you can obtain, for example, by doing the partition function on a sphere. And in higher dimensions, if the dimension is even, you have these anomalies that I have already talked about. So this, the idea is that the generalization of the C, the quantity that you want to look at for providing a theorem in higher dimensions, is the coefficient of the Euler anomaly in any dimensions. This, in fact, was recently proved in 2011. It's called the A theorem because of the naming of this coefficient in four dimensions. It's called the A theorem, and it was proved by Komarowski and Schumann. With some standard methods or standard ideas of positivity in quantum field theory, not using entanglement entropy. So and so this, it seems that this idea of Cardi holds, and the question is whether there is a C theorem in all dimensions, because anomalies, as I, these trace anomalies are not present in all dimensions. So nobody has a clue of this except that in 2010, Myers and Sinha were studying remineralization group flows using holography, and they got an idea of what would be the quantity to look at in all dimensions. The idea was that they look at several models where you have a remineralization group flow along the coordinate that goes to the bulk, and they computed some quantity that was going down, so it was like a candidate for the C theorem, and was going down. They identified the quantity just because it was proportional to the null-energy condition that is supposed to hold. It's like because the bulk is like classical, so there is an energy condition there that holds in classical theories. So you would obtain something like this, and you have to identify what is proportional to this. And in even dimension, they got the same result as Cardi proposal, is proportional to the anomaly at the fixed points. But for all dimensions, they were looking at many different quantities to see what matches to these results. And what they found was that it was the constant term on the entanglement entropy of a sphere. On the other hand, some people, Jaferis, Klebanov, Pufo, and Safi, were doing something completely different. They had a tool to compute some particular quantity that is the partition function on a d-dimensional sphere for some supersymmetric theories that are interacting and complicated. And then they, using this tool, they realized that in many examples of remineralization group flow, they found that this F quantity, this log set, was going down along the normalization group flow. We have already seen that these two things are related to each other in all dimensions, because the F quantity, the constant term in the partition function here in the free energy, is equal to the constant term on the entanglement entropy of a sphere in all dimensions. So these two proposals turn out to be the same. So you have here a plot of the proposals in different dimensions. In even dimensions is the logarithmic coefficient either of entanglement entropy of a sphere or the partition function of the free energy of a d-dimensional sphere, and is the constant term in all dimensions. So it has an entropic formulation or a free energy formulation in both cases. And of course, in the even cases, this free energy formulation, this entropic formulation, also has expression in terms of the anomaly. But now the idea is to prove it in three dimensions, where usual ideas of quantum field theory, at least up to now, cannot have not given the C theorem. And the idea was to do some generalization of the idea here in two dimensions. Just take, now instead of intervals, we take some circles, because we want to compute the constant term of the entropy of a circle. And then you have to use a strong subadditivity. But then you have two problems. The first one is that if you take two circles, the intersection and the union will not be circles, so you have more parameters that add up. So you cannot go to some unique inequality of some dimensionful quantity. That's, the entropy depends on only one number. So this is a problem. It's not useful in this sense. But then this problem can be dealt with just taking many circles. So you take circles, take a point that is not in the center and rotate it. So you get something like this. And applying repeatedly the strong subadditivity, you get to some inequalities like this, where you have n times the same entropy of the original circle rotated. And on the other side of the inequality, you get the union of all this, so it's a bigger circle. And the last one is the intersection, so it's a small circle. And in the middle, you have these unions of intersections, and it's always symmetric set. And here is shown one of these. So the idea is that if you go to the limit of infinitely many rotated circles, this will go to some circle again. And then you have an inequality between circles and circles that is what you want. But the second problem was that you have here in the intersection new angles that will spoil the inequality. But this is solved by putting these circles on a null cone. Because in a null cone, the lines on the null cone will cut in a null plane locally, and there is no geometrical measure of the angle. The scalar product will give you one. It's the same as two lines that are aligned that do not have any measure of the angle, so they have no logarithmic term. So, and this is good, nice, because it's the same ideas in two dimensions that you have to put things boosted to each other. So if you boost the circles, in general, if you slant a circle like this, you will say, well, this is an ellipse. But in a relativistic case, in the null cone, it's still a circle, because it's just a boosted of a spatial circle. So you get circles here, and then you rotate them, and you obtain, as the wiggle sets that I shown, something like this, but with the wheels lying on null planes. And then you can take the continuum limit of this, and you get some inequality like this one involving an integral. And again, you do Taylor expansion for small deviations, and you get this inequality here. Just simple inequality that the second derivative of the circle as a function of radius is negative. And with that, you can obtain that this quantity, is always decreasing. And this quantity at the fixed point where you expect an expansion like this, with this is the constant term that you are aiming to, is exactly selecting, it eliminates this combination, eliminates the R term there, and only get the constant term. So this again tells you that the constant term will go down, this C of R will go down, and at the fixed point, it will match the constant term of the ultraviolet and the infrared theory. So it's providing the missing proof of this F theorem or C theorem in three dimensions. It is interesting also that this inequality, this same inequality, also give you an inequality for the area term. So the area term will be dressed as you go from the ultraviolet to the infrared, because of the massive particles, and then it will change this coefficient as you go to larger radius, and this area term will always go down. It will always have a negative renormalization. This is provided again by the, this same inequality. And in fact, recent work have improved that the total running of this area term is given by this formula. So this is a formula very similar to the Samolodchikov formula for the running of the C charge in two dimensions. In fact, it's a generalization that holds for any dimensions. So this is the way the area term goes. The total change of the area term from the ultraviolet to the infrared in any dimensions, the only thing that changes is a coefficient here. And in two dimensions, in most of the cases, this will be finite. And automatically, if it's finite, it's negative as provided by this inequality. So there is the issue that I raised in the first talk that the constant term is not like the logarithmic term in even dimension that is quite solid, and you change your cutoff, you will always get the same. But the constant term is a little bit more delicate, and you have to treat it with care. In fact, in order to define it properly, you have to do this mutual information regularization that I talk about, that you have to take a circle and a circle outside with some small distance between them and take the limit of very small distance so you can expand the mutual information in a similar way as the entropy and then take the constant term of the mutual information. In most of the cases, doing the appropriate regularization, you can show that this will be exactly the same as some good regularization calculation of the circle entropy. But for example, in here, if I take the circle in a square lattice that I shown in the first lecture, and I take the constant term, it will always like be fluctuating, so it doesn't give you any number. But when you do the mutual information, it converges, and in fact, subtracting the area term that is known by other methods, you can get some number that is the same number that people obtain doing analytic calculations of the partition function on a three sphere, for example. So, and there is also a generalization of this proof using the mutual information. So what about higher dimensions? Can we go to higher dimensions? And the answer is that up to now is that no, at least as simple as we have done for two and three dimensions. And the problem is that when you do this, the intersections before were only just an angle singularity, but in higher dimensions it will be some curves, some trihedral angles and dihedral angles with some curvature, and this will provide some divergent pieces that will make your inequalities trivial, in the sense that you will get something less than infinity, let's say. So you can also see that because Strong subjectivity is an inequality, a linear inequality between two things, four objects like here. So when you do small deviations, you will always get some second derivative inequality. So from Strong subjectivity, you can only get second derivative inequalities. With a second derivative inequality, you cannot obtain something that you have one of these derivatives, you can use it for saying that something is decreasing, like this one. But this something, then this something has to be defined with only one derivative. And the, as here, for example, as here. So with only one derivative, you cannot kill all the ambiguities a formula for the entropy of a sphere has in four dimensions. So it's not enough, somehow it's not enough the Strong subjectivity inequality. So you would need some inequality for more objects or nonlinear or something like that. That would be very interesting also from the point of view of quantum information theory. So this is my end comments. So there is a C theorem in 1 plus 1 and 2 plus 1 dimensions. For relativistic theories, we don't know how to generalize this because it's very dependent on Lorentz symmetry to non-relativistic theories. And up to now, the proof in 2 plus 1 dimensions can only be done with this entanglement entropy. And in fact, it's quite natural that it's this way because this constant term of the entropy of the circle also contains, for example, the topological entropy for topological theories that is defined with some entanglement entropy. So if the theorem contains this topological entropy as an important part of the quantity, it's difficult that this quantity can be obtained with some correlation functions on some other notion that is not, let's say, non-local. But then we have this C theorem expressed in terms of the entropy, what is nice, but we would like the one original question is that the C theorem means something like some information loss, something that is lost between the ultraviolet and the infrared, that we can understand why it's lost using information theory. And this proof, even if they involve the entropy, do not seem to give a nice understanding of this question. So we don't know really what is lost between ultraviolet and infrared. Because it's not the, for example, in 2 plus 1 dimension, it's not the entropy, but some small piece on the entropy that we would like to understand this piece itself, what it means in quantum information theory. And we don't have this understanding. Okay, this is my end. Thank you. Some quantities, sorry?
So in a lot of these quantities, yeah. Different C quantities or A quantities, whatever yeah. It is, you're computing at least the entanglement entropy picture, the free energy picture, you compute some quantity with respect to a disk or a sphere, and then you see how the quantity depends on the radius
yeah.
Of the region. What I don't exactly understand is why exactly does that, when I think about RG, there's also some notion of, there's a course, how does this account for the course gradient procedure of RG?
There is no coarse grain, so no. What you have to say is that if you have a quantity that depends on that is a dimensionless quantity that depends on R, let's say, then so in order that it's dimensionless, it has to depend on R and in fact some scale on the theory. So you can think in two ways. One is how it moves with R, that is what I've done, or you can say how it moves with the quantity, the other quantity that has dimensions that belongs to the theory. And this you can interpret as the renormalization group scale. You understand that? So it's the same because it's this quantity, because it's dimensionless and well-defined in the continuum limit, has to depend on the product of this, let's say, renormalization group scale and R. Suppose you write all your coupling constant in the theory that maybe have dimensions. You write them in terms of dimensionless coupling constants and some mu scale. Right, so the entropy, this C quantity, not the entropy, has to be a function of this because it's the only way it can be dimensionless and well-defined. So when you move R, you can say, well, I'm in fact moving in the opposite way the scale of the normalization group. along the marginal direction. Well, if it's, well, in two dimensions, this is known. This comes from the Samolyachnikov theorem. The fact that the Samolyachnikov theorem gives you that the change of C is equal to the integral of some theta is a correlator of the stress tensor traces, and here is a x what? 3, 2? What? Square, right? To kill the dimensions, it has to be square. Some constant there. So if the C doesn't change, then it must be the case because this is always positive. So if C doesn't change, this has to be zero. And if this is zero for all x, it means the operator itself is zero. So if the operator trace is zero, it means that you are always in a conformal phase, and then you don't move from there. So you cannot run from one to the other. If you have a line, let's say, of, I don't know if that's what you, in three dimensions, there is an analogous thing to this one. I can show you. There is no flow. Yeah, this is telling you there is no flow. Yeah, but if you have, you are saying that you have a line with the same C, right? Then there is no flow in this line. Yeah, perhaps John can answer. Yeah, the question is if you have a line of theories with the same C, then? Please, Heigl, louder. For me, your question is somehow confusing because you want to go from something to other that cannot be. There is no representation group flow that goes from. Yeah. Ah, okay. You are computing the entanglement entropy for two theories. No flow between them. Yeah. No, sure, there must be something, perhaps not in the single interval, right? But because if the theories are different, the difference come from somewhere, and I don't know. And I just comment that in 2 plus 1, there is kind of idea similar that as the area term runs with this, so it's again like the Samolyachnikov sum rule. If theta is different from zero, the area term will run. And if the area term runs, and the area term is an integral of S second derivative, it means that S second derivative that always have the same sign is different from zero. And if different from zero, it will induce a different from zero running of the C char. So again, it means that if you have a running, the C of the ultraviolet, the C and the infrared has to be different. Of course, there is a slight subtlety that this quantity could, in fact, be divergent in some cases. But it's a divergent that appears in the ultraviolet mainly. But still, in the divergent cases, you can say that it has to run in order to get divergent. So the total running of the area can be divergent because it has. This R, while the total running of the constant term can be finite at the same time.
Let's take one last question. The new there in the last line, that's in the perturbed state?
This thing is a computed in a theory that has some scale, and then you have to compute this, and this. This give you the total running of the area term.
Well, this is in the perturbed theory.
I don't understand this language. It's just a theory that has some scale. Perturbed, you say that you created by perturbing the ultraviolet. Okay.
The definition of mu is a couple lines up.
Yeah. This is mu. The whole flow of the constant of the area term.
Yes, but the bottom line doesn't refer to the whole flow.
This quantity gives you the same as this, but these are very different, written in very different way. This is just integral of second derivative of entropy of circles from zero to infinity, and this is just normal correlators of quantum field theory. It's a sum, like a sum rule for the area term.
Okay.